Okay, here's my talk, which will address the following two questions, and here are also the answers. I was given 15 minutes to do this, so I have one more. Sure we can. Does singularity resolution depend on the quantum state? The answer is certainly yes. Right? And does the no-boundary wave function formulated in the low-energy effective theory of quantum gravity say something about singularities? My answer is probably not. And I will now just amplify on these points. From the most general point of view, quantum mechanics is a theory that predicts probabilities for alternative coarse-grained histories of the universe. And three things are needed to calculate these probabilities. First is the theory of the dynamics represented in simple models by a Hamiltonian. Then is the initial state. And two, three, a description of the histories. You don't have all these ingredients, that you don't get any predictions at all, and that's why issues of singularity certainly will depend on the state. To give you a simple model, just consider particles in a box, and the usual rule for probabilities for a history, for example, which we might take to be given by taking a series of times and specifying which of the set of intervals the particle goes through. That's given the sum over history formulation by an expression looks like this. Sum of all paths, x and p, that actually thread those little intervals, all the alpha, right, acting on the quantum state, squared. Of course, these histories have to be decoherent, right? Otherwise, you don't get consistent probabilities, but I won't talk anything about coherence today. Anyway, the point is, if you don't have any state, right, you know, use this formula, you don't get any probabilities. Sometimes states themselves can be constructed by summed over histories. As in this example, the ground state, this is a particle moving in a potential, can be constructed from a Euclidean. Where the sum typically is in Euclidean time, and we want the wave function evaluated at x naught, we sum over all the paths that go up to some boundary condition here in the paths. But these paths, as this example clearly illustrates, are not necessarily the paths for which you want to predict probabilities for. These are Euclidean after all. Just for a particle, we want to predict probabilities for a set of histories that are moving in real time. That's why this third piece of this is absolutely essential. So if you're interested in singularity theorem removal from this point of view, the first question to ask is, whatever set of histories you're dealing with, does the set of histories have singular histories? Singular ones. If that's not the case, that is, it doesn't. There are no singular histories, and the question is moot. Right? You've already answered it. And I suppose that might be the case in loop quantum gravity. We can discuss this further. If it does, then it's a probabilistic question, and the singularities are resolved if the probability of a singular history is zero. This probability will certainly depend on the state, right, as I've just illustrated. So that's my first set of answers here.
And yes. If the first statement is not true, or sorry, is true, if the set of allowed histories does not include singularities, then it's state independent.
Right? Yeah.
That's a lot of
none of the alternatives are singular. Let's say, for example, in the case of the particle paths, right, then there isn't any issue of singularities, period.
Well, so why do you, in that case, you wouldn't put yes there?
Nothing to resolve.
Yes, if it's a question.
So what if the probability is zero for all states?
For all what?
For all states.
Well, that's a much stronger result. Then I think you could just leave out the singular histories unless they were required by continuity or something for the original set. That is, if you have something that never occurs, what's the point of having it in the first place?
This does bring us to one of the important issues here, because in this framework, what starts out by giving a classical configuration space and considering paths in that. Mm-hmm. And now we are asking about what are the allowed histories and so on. Mm-hmm. So, but if I don't have a full quantum theory, I may not know what the classical configuration space should be. Mm-hmm. For example, if I have a quantum theory which says that singularities are resolved, then I would have one configuration space. If it says that they are not resolved, then there would be another configuration space. If there's another one which says that, in fact, space-time description doesn't make any sense at all, as, for example, was proposed coming from string theory or something, then these histories that I'm writing down are not very useful.
Well, at every step, in order to calculate probabilities, you have to be able to say what you're calculating the probabilities of, I think. Right. So you have to make some assumption about what the histories are. Then you proceed. You may want to modify your theory in light of what the results come out, which is what you're saying. And so you proceed, I presume, in an iterative manner.
Okay. Can tell me, just when you mean probability zero, you mean a very small weight.
Well, what about the entropy?
Some resistances are simply pumping up the antibiotic. Or destroying antibiotics.
There are many such configurations.
All new function, which is usually in bacteria acquired through horizontal gene transfer. Look for these antibiotics, which are, by the way, belonging to a different family of antibiotics. They act in such a way that mutations in target can render cells.
A notion of counting the number of specific ones. So you have to, really all this should refer to coarse-grained histories that are singular. But you know, you can get some idea by shrinking the first screening down to smaller and smaller levels.
So in just plain old quantum mechanics, I mean,
this is plain.
With no gravity, I mean, we would probably regard something that, say, goes off to infinity at a finite level as singular. So in ordinary quantum mechanics, we include such paths, but their probability is zero. And therefore, things are resolved, or those not regarded by singular.
I would say, I mean, for example, an upside down harmonic oscillator has the I believe the character you're talking about.
No, it doesn't.
No. Some potential we can run off with.
Steeper than
a harmonic oscillator. Right. Yeah. And you can run off and then come back, and you may declare that to be singular, and it will have a finite probability. In that case, you didn't resolve the singularity. But on the other hand, it doesn't seem to be particularly dangerous either.
Well, there's a sort of loss of predictability, but I mean, regardless of the potential, right? I mean, I could certainly include a history where something runs off to infinity and a finite amount of time.
Right.
Is the point of view that you know, regardless of the potential, one includes those histories, but if the potential isn't bad, somehow quantum mechanics tells us that their probability is zero?
No, the issue is rather, if you want to decide this question, right, you first have to tell me what singularities are in terms of the histories, and then we calculate, right, the probabilities, and then find out whether the probabilities are zero for those histories or not. So I'm not claiming any singularities are necessarily bad, right? I just asked whether they were resolved.
I think David's statement is true. If you take a normal quantum system that has a potential boundary below the set, and you ask your question about what is the probability for history goes off to infinity and comes back, and you find it's zero.
Yeah. So.
Okay, so ordinary quantum mechanics, we do include singular histories, but we conclude that they have probability zero unless the potential is bad.
Right.
Okay.
Or at least we can choose to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the first part. Three more minutes. Okay, the null boundary for this. This was motivated originally by the idea that if the universe is a quantum mechanical system, it has some state. So what is it? And the idea was that we could write down a simple formula for an attractive theory, if you like, in the initial state.
Initial state or least state?
V state. The theory of the initial condition. And this had attractive features in long sum suitable time place. Kantor, in particular, was the cosmological analog of the ground state, and we observed that the universe was a simple state early on. The fluctuations were small, some less homogeneous and isotropic. The idea here is that you should sum over all the geometries which have the topology of a disk. I'll draw this a poem, this tradition. So you specify H, I, J, and here, and chi. So these geometries were supposed to be non-singular. And that's, of course, a problematic notion in path integrals where the often the paths are non-differentiable, but it could be implemented in the case of semi-classical approximations to this integral, so semi-classically. We did get wave functions that were, you know, mostly Euclidean down here, mostly Lorentzian up here. And these produce useful results like, you know, predictions for the values of the spectrum and the fluctuations and the, well, a number of other features. In fact, but the effort was, and from this, we could, with a suitable generalization that I talked about before, we could in principle compute the probabilities for these histories. But the theory was always implemented in a low energy effective theory. And the reason for that was the questions of interest were more like how the theory of the state predict the large scale features of the universe that we see, the approximate homogeneity and isotropy, the spectrum density fluctuations, the fact that it was large compared to the Planck scale, and even the existence of classical spacetime itself, which is, for a general state, is not going to be really quantitative. So it did that.
So do you think of this as logged on to inflation? Consider there to be an inflationary phase in there, or
well, there could be. Depends exactly on what the action is. So, the typical models that people worked out did have an inflationary phase.
You mean at the stationary point of the path integral?
At the stationary point of the
path. There are always included paths that have inflationary.
Yeah, I meant the stationary point, evaluating the semi-classical approximation. But the theory was still a low-energy effective theory of quantum gravity, and I don't see how you're going to answer questions about, you know, singularities, right, at the level that are being discussed in this conference, just by using this particular theory constructed from the low-energy. It was directed at a different set of questions, not whether the singularities were resolved so much as what were the predictions for the large-scale features of the universe.
You're saying that because it's to do with the ground state.
You're
saying that because it's to do with the ground state, which has to do with late time.
It's the analog of the ground state, yeah, in the sense that for ordinary Hamiltonian theory, you can calculate the ground state in two ways, right? One is as a low cycle state of Hamiltonian, the other is as a Euclidean integral over an appropriate set of paths. Here, because Hamiltonian for closing universe is zero, we don't have the first option, but we did have the second. That was the argument. So I don't think it's going to answer the questions that you want to have answered in this way. But there's still the basic quantum cosmological question. What is the state of the universe? Or what is the null boundary proposal for better quantum theories of gravity? And I believe that's what we're still waiting for in string theory, and also possibly quantum. Thank you.
Well, I'm
the first person in the whole world. We should give speakers fewer minutes, and then. Sure, questions are certainly allowed. Yeah.
But I don't know if this is out of order. I mean, so I'd like to ask a question about the interpretation of this wave function. But is that out of bounds for this discussion?
Me.
I thought we were talking about no bounds.
Okay, so how are we supposed to interpret this wave function? I mean, when you said it would tell you the probability of, you know, let's say we see something.
Okay, in my 17 minutes, there's a whole story called, you know, generalized quantum mechanics, which tells you how to compute, right, in simple models, for example, exactly what the probabilities are. Those have been implemented in various many superspace models, right? And they have some formal structure, at least for the whole theory, based on a metric theory of gravity. And so they do prescribe definite predictions for the probabilities of classes of histories.
Right, but not the probabilities of just different three geometries and matter fields.
No, for geometry. So that I should have said, right? And this is like this. Okay. Prescription for the wave function.
Right.
I erased the other part of it. So it weights possible Lorentzian histories for a closed universe.
I think there's a fundamental difference between, in quantum mechanics, say you did this for the harmonic oscillator, that function psi naught would tell me that if I observe the position of the oscillator, what's the relative probability of different finding it at different locations?
Right.
In this particular state.
Right.
I don't think you mean for us to use the no boundary wave function in the same way. Or
yes. So, for example,
there's no normalization that's natural to the that I can understand in the cosmological case.
Well, that's for if we just have a particle. It's psi of x right down here, and then we can calculate the probability for a path.
Well, I guess we can do that because we have a Hilbert space. I mean,
right.
We happen to calculate this one-wave function, but there's also all other wave functions. I guess Ted's question is that here, this will be the wave function. We don't have kind of other wave functions. I don't have an inner product. So how do I?
Well, you try to decide, jump over that, so to speak, by defining the amplitudes for these as sums over the coarse grain histories between beginning and final states.
Yeah.
Attach the wave function.
You might want to remember our paper, just a suggestion.
maybe you should remember the paper for.
All right. Well, you could take, if you say write down some relational observable points, you could compute their expectation values in this wave function.
That's still not a history, I think, although Don may disagree with it.
It's a closely related idea. Yeah.
But it makes more sense to me than this. I mean, it sounds like you were wanting to say, yeah, you can consider the relative probability of finding space to be yay big or twice as big.
Mm-hmm.
But by evolution, it may be both yay big and twice as big later. So it's just not the right question. What's the probability that space is a certain size? So that's just not.
Okay.
So that's different from the case of the harmonic oscillator ground state, where it is meaningful to say, what's the probability that in this state the particle is in this interval?
So
I think it's fundamentally different.
You have to be careful, as Steve was stressing, what exactly are the observables? If you restrict attention to paths, then the observables are diffeomorphism and variant partitions of the paths into classes. So you can't partition the
morning. Did you know?
Class by giving the size on one surface, because the surface may repeat itself. So a question like, does the universe ever get to a volume bigger than V0 is a question, or doesn't it? Sometime, right? That is a diffeomorphism.
Right. Okay.
So, I agree. It's not, the analogy doesn't carry over completely, of course. Right?
Thank you.
So for the second question, so just to understand, So if I, supposing there are two calculations, one of them is actually, say, really a bounce, and the other one is a wave function, which actually this is this kind of form out of which classical universe is born at some stage. And I now can understand, these two people have their wave functions, and you're saying, and you are supposed to calculate what the wave function is. And you're saying that, well, you might be able to reproduce both these wave functions. You're saying that you cannot distinguish between what happened before.
If you have a theory in that there's one state, and if you have a different theories of the state, then you can calculate each theory.
So, at some late time, the two wave functions might actually agree, although initially, what happens via the singularity may be very different answers. And is the idea then that this will just give you that wave function at late times, but doesn't really distinguish between what happened in the early times?
I'm not talking about sort of evolving the wave function up here and then just taking some surface and doing some calculation. I'm talking about using these geometries as weights for histories or geometries.
Ultimately, you're giving me a wave function.
You're giving me a wave function, yes.
And both the classes of histories that you have in mind are contained with this particular wave function. They're just wave
I guess 17 minutes was a little short.
I think Alvin is asking the question. So you said that your original Debugger proposal does not answer the question about singularities. But you also said it's an interesting question to ask, what is the no-boundary wave function for some more complete
theory? That's only
kind of. Right, not just based on some classical theory. I think Alvin is asking the question, if I give you a more complete theory, and you compute in that theory the no-boundary wave function, should it be able to tell you about the probability of singularities?
I presume. I don't know. Since it should give you the probability of every history, it should give you the probability of singular histories, I would guess.
So what goes wrong if I try to push this? I mean, so now I have gravitational collapse, and I'm making a black hole with a really nasty singularity, and what I want to know is, you know, does it actually stay singular, or does it bounce and do some other stuff? So now I look at this picture, and I say, all right, you know, let me write down a whole bunch of, you know, four manifolds, some singular, some not. Let me, you know, sum over all of those and calculate the relative probability of, you know, the black hole bouncing or staying singular. So what is it that goes wrong? Is it that the action is wrong, or the measure is wrong, or the whole picture is wrong? What breaks down?
Where was the breakdown?
That's what I want to know.
Well, why should it break down?
Why can't I just use this picture to answer the question of, you know, when I pull a black hole from gravitational collapse, does it really go singular or not? And if not, what does it bounce back to?
Well, I presume you could if you had an accurate theory of gravity and you could express those old properties. Well, I don't think this will do it very well, right? Because exactly where the interesting questions are, where the effective low energy theory, we presume, breaks down.
Okay, so we lose confidence in the action or the measure or even the whole picture where things are getting interesting. So it's like the old characterization of the Federal Reserve as taking the punch bowl away just when the party gets going.
Well, we thought classical space time, when the universe gets large, the spectrum of population, the low initial entropy, that those were interesting questions.
Yes, I agree. But there is this long class of interesting questions for which the punch bowl gets ganked away just when things get going.
Well, this is a pretty old punch bowl. Right? I should have made some progress on this by now.
On that note, we'll contemplate that punch bowl.
Okay. So last week, I guess, in the context of the discussion of black hole singularities, someone said those awful words, alpha parameters, and it was thought it'd be a good idea to have a talk about them or a discussion. And much as I hate them, I'm actually working on the subject right now, so natural person to do it. So
I want to, so this was in the context of black holes, but there's a, they actually froze first, and probably they're easier to think about in the context of Euclidean wormhole solutions to gravity. Their effect, which is alpha parameters, or their claimed effect. And then what can we learn? This is the new bit. What can we learn from ADS CFT? This is with Nimar Khani Hamed and Jacopo Borghera, who, are you here, Jacopo? No.
Okay.
Jacopo. And then if there's time, this best part would be Reed coming back to black holes. So, I know, sometime around 1989, Steve Giddings and Andy Strominger found an interesting solution to the equation of Euclidean gravity. So with your action just being usual curvature term plus a three-form field strength. So again, this is a three-form field strength. It's the curl of some potential.
Why they are selected for?
For a three-form in four dimensions, you could also express this in terms of the gradient of a massless scalar. But for various reasons, it's simpler to use the three-form language. And this is natural, too, because these three-form field strengths come up in many ways in string theory. So the solution is simple. The topology is just S3 cross R, and it looks like this. It's an asymptotically flat region. It narrows down. The cross section here is the S3, and then the second asymptotically flat region. So it's a wormhole localized, and so it's totally localized from the point of view of the outside in Euclidean spacetime, which connects to asymptotically flat Euclidean four-dimensional spaces. And it's supported by the flux, so the integral on the three sphere of the flux is some integer in appropriate units, which in string theory is something like this. Alpha prime is the string length squared. Okay, so the question is, what is the significance of this solution to Euclidean quantum gravity? Well, first of all, although to describe it, I needed this, although as drawn, it has two different asymptotic regions, there would be, if even with one asymptotic, one Euclidean space, there would be very good approximate solutions in which the two ends of the wormhole are far apart. So as this is the same solution, I've cut it in half and put one half here and one half here, and these are glued. And in the spirit of for example, instanton dilute gas sums, if the separation is large compared to the size of the wormhole, this is an approximate setup point. We know it makes sense to expand around it. Now, also the size of the throat here, the radius, is something like the square root of q times the string scale, which is something like the square root of q times the Planck length times g string to some negative power. So if q, the charge, is large and or g string is small, then this radius is large compared to the Planck scale, and so this is a solution in a regime where you can use just the low energy effective action, and so it should make sense. So the question is what? First of all, of course, I think nobody really knows what Euclidean quantum gravity is, but there's kind of a working approach that if you find a saddle point, you assume it's part of you assume you include it and see what it gives you. And so when this was first considered by Steve and Andy, I think the original idea was that it was a concrete model of local loss of quantum coherence that you'd expect, for example, produced by virtual black holes. Because you can imagine a couple of particles falling into one end of this wormhole and falling out the other end, and whatever information they carry would locally be lost. And so this was a model, again, of local information.
And so the question is, please.
There was something I meant to say. It'll come back to me later. If there are any questions or comments, I mean, there's other people who've worked on this subject who might have other takes on things, but this is my recollection. Okay, so this was supposed to be modeled in facial loss, but very quickly, Sidney Coleman argued that it wasn't, that we in fact couldn't lose, that it had a different effect. These wormholes are, say, a factor of 10 larger than the Planck length. We can parametrically make them a factor of 10 larger than the Planck length, so that they're large enough that one can use
microsatellites inside
them, but small enough that we can think like of these as points on the scale of any other probe. And so,
this is the way those bacteria escape hosting
immunity. Then, to very good approximation, in terms of low energy physics, the effect of being in this geometry is the same as simply having flat space time.
It's one of a protein feature.
Local operators, some complete set of local operators, some set of coefficients. So
this,
the effect of the wormhole is just some sum over a complete set of local operators, OI of X, OJ.
This was Coleman's assumption that small wormholes would, so this actually is
not just Coleman's assumption. This is just normal analysis of small. But the next step, one way of thinking about what Coleman said. Now, first of all, if you have this saddle point, so the effect of doing the path integral, the effect of physics in this background is the same as the effect of physics in this background, but with this bilocal operator. Yes?
Well, maybe to add something partly.
Yes.
Response to Eva. So there's another way of thinking about this, and that is that you should extend somehow your Hilbert space to include the degrees of freedom that go off into the bigger universes.
I actually was just meaning to ask about the large wormhole problem,
Now, if you have one wormhole, you can have many. And so the effect of something over all such topologies is just to exponentiate this. And so the effect of the wormhole is just to introduce into your path integral, your Euclidean path integral, a weight factor. Let me put a half in here, it doesn't really matter. But now, there's one more thing, which is I should have done this before I exponentiated. But these two ends, of course, can be anywhere. They don't have to be any specific x. I have to integrate over all places to put them. And so I have to insert in here also an integral over all places they could be. And this kind of collective coordinate reduction of classical solutions automatically preserves coordinate variance. So if this is a basis of scalar operators, then there'll be root g's in there. So far,
Cij don't depend on x minus y.
I'm sorry.
Cij depend on x minus y.
No, they do. Cij were already defined over here. In some sense, can already be defined over here. They don't depend on x minus y. There's a small force between the two ends that falls as a power, but that's in some sense that's in some sense appears when you integrate at a later stage. It's not present yet. The Cij just comes from sort of integrating out the fields near the two ends and replacing them with local operators.
So can you have linear or cubic terms?
Yes, you could. We can think about those later. Yeah. So this looks bilocal, but there's a standard way to rewrite it, which is we'll introduce just a bunch of integration variables, which are not fields, they're just variables. And then this bilinear thing that I've written over here, if you can see it over there, just becomes the integral over all the of all the alphas, e to the minus alpha I integral d4 x root g of x oi of x, and then so we can take the bilinear thing and just, in a standard way, represent it in terms of a Gaussian auxiliary field as a, and then something which is linear and local on in space-time.
Treatments. Think back at the end.
No. They're just variables of integration. They're just numbers. They're not fields. They couldn't be fields because coordinate invariance kind of requires that this appear in this form. Right. And also,
why are we not worried about the fact that when x and y are close together, this is the wrong description?
When x and y are close together, well, this again, the same thing happens with instant time calculations in field theory, which is that in that regime you need to correct this. But let's focus on the regime where they're not close together. Okay. Let's understand that first.
Some subleading in the Duluth gas.
Right. It'll just sort of make things more nonlinear, but yeah. Now we already have so this effect. So again, the summing over these geometries is like doing working in the flat space time, close to the flat space time, fluctuates around the flat space time, but with this additional insertion in the path integral. And let's remember that we already have in there the normal action, whatever action we get from our fundamental theory, which is just a sum over all scalars times a coupling for each scalar. And so the whole effect of these geometries is that you replace the original coupling with gi plus alpha I. And so now when you integrate when you consider a transition from some initial state to some final state, you have these alphas are roughly like super selection sectors. You sort of have not one quantum mechanics problem, but you have, or one transition amplitude, but you have the transition amplitude for each alpha. For each fixed value of the alphas, it's just an ordinary quantum mechanics with a shifted coupling. But then there is some,
then
at the end of the day, probabilistic. Well, some, at the end of the day, some
they,
integration.
They cannot
alpha
really
alpha
evolve anymore.
And now the trilinear couplings and also the wormhole collisions and so on presumably can be represented as higher, more complicated functions of alpha.
How do you call them super selection sectors?
Well, okay. So let's think about if this is really going on. Well, the alphas again, back here we have this bilinear function, and we to factorize it, we only need, again, this is a number, not a function of position. So the very first person to measure the fine structure constant, they measured 1 over 137. And it might, in the fundamental theory it had a different value, but then it was shifted by alpha. Once they measured which sort of slice of this once they measure the effective value of alpha, every future experimentalist also gets 1 over 137.
Is that statement clear from this formalism, or is that something else that we're...
Well, no, I think it's like decoherence. If you have a quantum superposition of different values of the coupling constants, then very quickly, universes with different values will look macroscopically different.
Bacteria.
Classical observers.
And in fact,
on what spatial scale?
Well, again, they're constant. So you can't see. There's no. They don't fluctuate. They don't fluctuate from position to position.
Even given the Big Bang and possible inflation and things like that. And you really mean the whole universe?
At this point, yes. Because even if we had meant These can be arbitrarily, well, I remember what I meant to say. Again, these wormholes, it's just an aside, but these wormholes are, you know, they don't require any kind of funny matter to support them. The matter is just ordinary positive, you know, ordinary matter that appears in string theory. But anyway, these ends could be, this could be today, and this could be in the Big Bang, this could be here, and this could be 11,000 bubbles away. And so, in fact, these are really, even if you have, you know, a tremendous chaotic universe, these alphas are the same everywhere.
Sounds like a massive violation of causality.
But it sounds like it, but the practical effect is simply that your fundamental theory is worthless because what you measure differs from it by random fluctuations. Now, we have the landscape today, and we have something similar to deal with, but this is on top of the landscape because even if we are in a very definite vacuum of string theory, a very definite geometry, a very definite set of G's, then these alphas are quantum random variables on top. Garrett?
Yeah, I just want to, again, understand. So right now you said wormholes give you this sort of non-local looking thing. You can rewrite it that like
right.
that with an integral over alpha.
Right.
And now you're sort of saying that, well, we should imagine these alphas are basically being fixed and determined by measurements, and we don't have to do the integral over alphas anymore?
It's so non-local, it's effectively local, right? We're never going to see, well, you want to do anything?
Well, one way of saying it is, say you have some initial distribution about over alphas. It's like a wave function.
Right.
And if you perform measurements in our universe, then really you end up, in effect, collapsing that wave function into an alpha eigenstate is one way of saying it. There are different ways of describing, of course, wave function collapse, but that's one way of saying it. And you can actually see that explicitly. When we were figuring this story out, you can actually see that as you perform repeated experiments, you see the effect of collapsing into an alpha eigenstate. And one way of stating it is sort of initially it looks like you're losing information with each experiment, but the amount of information that you lose with each subsequent experiment goes down.
And we have
so you really, in a sense, collapse into a state.
In part of those,
yeah, you're not in an eigenstate of baby universe number, right?
Well, that's an alpha eigenstate base Euclidean. Okay. Well, not big universe number, but
yeah.
No, you could start in an arbitrary state, which is a superposition of the alpha eigenstates.
Yeah.
And so you start in an arbitrary state, but then as you start making measurements, you collapse into an eigenstate. Another way of saying it is the non-locality is a violation of cluster decomposition, and it would be just like any other situation where we're superposing, say, two theories. That cluster to get one that doesn't cluster, say, fine structure constant 1 over 136 and fine structure 1 over 137. You can think of a wave function, which is a superposition of those two. And as you perform experiments, again, you see this collapsing phenomenon into a state which does cluster.
But in fact, I mean, the part that I remain confused about is why should I think about the state as a function of alpha? At what point did alpha become an operator or something?
Well, Joe didn't say it that way. But when we were initially thinking about it, the way we thought about it is, well, gee, maybe universes can disappear off, can disconnect, and there ought to be some variables that describe that, so there should be a quantum state that describes that. So then you try to set up a description of that Hilbert space, and you quickly are led to a story that's essentially this, where the alphas are the eigenstates of basically the baby universe creation and annihilation.
So to do that, you talk about the baby universe, though. I can't just talk about this original.
Yeah, but you don't have to. I mean, I think if you start with a Big Bang here, you're going to end up here with a strongly decohered state in many directions, not just the alpha direction, but the alpha directions will certainly decohere. Jim?
So where, what is, was the justification for the dilute gas approximation?
Okay, so the only wormholes which are controlled are those which are larger than the Planck scale, and they correspondingly have a large action. So the density
this
goes as
what's
the size squared.
It is a hyper.
So by
they can
construction,
relatively rapidly adapt themselves to given environment. Then they have to change environment.
Well. If, for example, the string coupling is small, then there's a natural string theory cuts you off before you get to the Planck scale. So that would be a context in which these are genuine. There's a genuine small parameter that governs this.
But if string coupling is order one, then maybe things will crazy.
During
especially if it doesn't happen at all.
I read in a book somewhere that string theory doesn't have any parameters.
And you don't.
Not in the yeah the fundamental action doesn't have it, but the effective action. Right. This doesn't conflict with that. But again, that's actually let me mention an even stranger bit of history, which is not directly relevant to what I'm going to say. Maybe it is, but Coleman. Made the information laws go away, but at the cost of you know, the coupling constants have this random component, but then what he pointed out was that, okay, here's our universe, and let's imagine, what, you know, geometry is empty connected, so in every Euclidean world, if you have a cosmological constant, then four spheres have an action, which is minus m flock squared over lambda squared in some units. And so each of these bubbles has a path integral weight e to the m flock squared over lambda squared. And when you sum over all bubbles, you get e to the m flock squared over lambda squared. Except now it's lambda plus what appears in the calculation is the effective energy value of lambda. It's lambda plus its shift rate, it's the actual measured value of lambda, including the effect of wormholes.
Actually, I think no square.
No square. No square. Sorry, my apologies. Of course, no square. Yeah, thanks. Thanks. And so, if this, as you see, this thing blows up very badly as the physical value of lambda goes to zero in a positive direction. And so it seems as though the effect of these, they're not really disconnected because, of course, not only are wormholes doing this, but they're doing this, they're doing this, they're doing this. It seems as though the effect of these disconnected bubbles is to, in addition to the weight we had here, it provides this additional weight factor, which again explains why cosmological constant is zero back when we thought that. So this is very exciting. I have to say, I mean, there's a real appeal to this idea because, understand why lambda equals something small, we always said we need some kind of long distance, short distance mixing. Because to measure lambda, you've got to look at the universe on long scales. But lambda is a parameter in a Lagrangian, which is supposed to be determined by short distance physics. And that's what this picture does. These big bubbles measure lambda on long scales, and then feed it back to us in something which is effectively local. So it's a beautiful realization of UV-IR mixing. We got all excited for a year or two and wrote papers about this. I wrote a very technical and interesting paper about whether this sign is right, but the much more important question is whether this sign is right, the one coming from the Euclidean action. You know, Steve and other many people object to this because we all tend to think that the Lorentzian form of gravity is more fundamental. And if you start from the Lorentzian form and rotate to Euclidean space, you're not going to get positive exponentials, you're going to get negative ones. So, and other people argue that he gave the wrong prediction for theta QCD. It's a strange time. Anyway, this is a subject which never really came to a sharp
pressure.
People just ran out of things to say.
Hi, you remember. Depending.
Most of them didn't believe this story. But there's also, and nobody wanted, you know, it just kind of ended. And people suspected that none of it was true, but they didn't know why. And it was buried, and we didn't teach our students about it or tell them these things.
So it's a subject whose chance of being right is epsilon, but its importance is 1 over epsilon squared.
So we should all read.
This sounds like a new version of Pascal's wager.
Yes.
Yeah.
George, just one question. In principle, are the alphas supposed to be determined by string theory?
No. They're quantum random variables.
Yeah, okay. We've got the whole
thing. Yeah.
But where are you going to put them into string theory?
Yeah. Here. They're here. I mean, they're just, I pulled them out of string theory.
This is some cruder picture, right?
Right. So.
Theory. And when I try to embed this in string theory, could it not be that we will find, well, you can't really do that because there aren't any parameters in string theory, and when I correctly sum up that exponential you just erased, I'll get, in fact, get a delta function?
Well, I mean, that's what Coleman was in effect saying, right? That the sum turned into a delta function, which seems really cool. And I still have some affection for this idea, but nobody's ever found a way to make sense of it in a, you know, coherent framework for gravity.
But you're going to tell us about ADS-CFT,
right?
There's analogs of these
parameters. Right. Right. Really high energies where the couplings are meant to be going to some UV fixed point.
Yes.
I still have to add alpha to that. I mean,
let's suppose the string coupling is small, so these throats are parametrically larger than the Planck scale. When you go to short enough distances, you know, where you're seeing the 10-dimensional physics, you don't see this at that scale. You see definite physics at that scale. So there's
some mu dependence of alpha, right? So there's g plus alpha of lambda, and under some effective scale.
And there's this issue of in some cases you find that larger and larger work, because when you have something this divergent, and everything is divergent, you know, the way this blows up the lambda goes to zero, and so some calculations, as Eva was reminding, blow up in the large wormhole direction. It was really, you know, it was something that needed some rules to make sense of.
So you said that the subject was left somehow open. I thought your paper was the minus there.
This was a very technical paper that I think was
not technical, but it changed the whole thing. No?
Yeah. counting zero modes. I actually was hoping it was a positive paper that would sort of teach us how to make sense of the thing. But anyway, we all for different reasons abandoned it. I remember. Well, yeah. So
there's a loophole maybe in your paper or not?
Well, that's now. we now have at least in some situations what seems like an effectively complete definition of quantum gravity, particularly with ADS boundary conditions. So here's our ADS boundary, and here's our bulk. And of course, ADS is a kind of special space, and you can't ask every question about gravity. In particular, you can't get to sort of the, it's very hard to get to cosmology from here. We've heard talks about how you can try to ask cosmological questions. It's hard to get to the Sitter space from here, or to any of the phenomenologically interesting compactifications from here. But in fact, it's not so hard. I mean, to imagine that since it's easy to fit a wormhole into ADS space, and so this whole story should be taking. So we have this gauge theory, which crudely speaking lives on the boundary, and so it's constructing in the interior a sum over metrics. We know it includes some degree of topology change. For example, it includes the Hawking-Page transition, where you have periodic ADS space and the Euclidean ADS black hole, and then these, for example, topologies of Lunin and Maldacena. So we know that the gauge theory and the boundary includes to some extent the sum over topologies in the interior, and so we can try to ask the question: Does it include these wormholes?
But how are wormholes in the interior going to induce quantum uncertainty in the CFT?
Good. When you read papers about ADS-CFT, nobody ever includes any sum over these couplings in the bulk, and that's an interesting fact. And moreover, there does seem to be a conflict, which I will try to make more precise later on, between ADS-CFT and these things appearing, because as Steve has mentioned, they violate cluster decomposition. If I have two widely separated wormholes, there's a correlation because what goes in here comes out here. Whereas the boundary theory is an ordinary field theory with a local Hamiltonian and does satisfy cluster decomposition. And so, in fact, there seems to be, on the face of it, a conflict. It seems hard to imagine that these wormholes are in part being summed over in the interior, yes.
You said the field theory is cluster decomposition, yeah. But it's a conformal invariant theory. And, you know, as far as I remember, in quantum field theory, you talk about cluster decomposition, you talk about exponential.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Good. I'm talking now about the global ADS space for the gauge theory, but it's on the three sphere. So, in fact, it's gapped. And as an aside, you know, the work, one doesn't have to take n to infinity, as Hong discussed yesterday, the n to infinity limit might introduce interesting non-trivialities, but it's sufficient to take, you know, if this is 10 times the Planck length, this could be a meter or a kilometer, and so n can be safely finite. One doesn't have to take the large n limit to look for the physics of wormholes. And as I hinted by saying cluster decomposition, there seems to be a conflict here. But before we get to the conflict, actually very quickly after, I have to mention a red herring, which is very quickly after the discovery of ADS-CFT, Sujong Ray, especially, and a few years later, Maldacena and Mayaz, talked about wormhole-like solutions or contributions to the ADS death integral, but they were not of this type. And there's it's slightly hard, in fact. So here's my action. But as Steve and
complete
pointed out,
perfect restoration of function.
In string theory, when you have one of these three-form potentials, you usually have a scalar field, a modulus with it. And the modulus often blows up at finite distance. There's a dimensionless parameter in there, B, and there's three ranges of B where phi blows up at finite distance.
The pure population of the
infinity or not at all. And it seemed as though the simplest examples in string theory all
the
regime where phi blows up at finite distance or infinity, which means that you can't really fit these wormholes in this space they without changing the boundary conditions. And you don't want to change the boundary. Well,
they did.
You don't want to change the boundary conditions. You want to sort of stay with the field theory you know you've got and ask what's happening. And it turns out this is a red herring because shortly after their paper, Tom Bacchus showed that in string theory specified to d equals 4, there are, in fact, there are non-singular wormholes, which are a bit more complicated than the ones that Andy and Steve consider. They have more charges. Now, you would like to find a situation where you have an ADS-CFT correspondence that you understand and a wormhole solution that is parametrically under control. And it turns out, and this is what we've done, that in string theory on R6 cross T4, the Tom Bacchus trick can be used to find wormhole solutions that are, again, parametrically under control, larger than the Planck scale, but smaller than any other scale. And these can also be inserted into ADS3 cross S3
functional
cross T4, where there is a good dual description. This is less familiar than the ADS5 cross S5 duality. The dual here you can think of again as being some gauge theory, some 1+1 dimensional gauge theory in the infrared conformal limit. But it seems to be a well-defined problematic.
I told you.
So the dilaton is
also during recombination.
No, it's because
so when DNA is coming from foreign bacteria, mismatch repair rejects
the right set of charges.
But because you are mutated, minus, you find more easily.
For a while,
so you have high probability to restore back the mutated functions.
The rate. A good question. So,
but we know this is happening during evolutionary history of bacteria. E. coli.
Because it doesn't count against my time when it's a question. The entire discussion so far has been in Euclidean signature.
Now, in the field theory dual, on the field theory side of ADS-CFT, it's a field theory and it's a totally well-defined operation to continue from Euclidean to Minkowski. The e to the IHT can be continued to measure at times. It's not clear how, I mean, we all know that it's problematic to make that continuation directly in the bulk, but we seem to have sort of Euclidean CFT, Lorentzian CFT, and the evidences and arguments for duality seem to apply to each. So, LADS, EADS. So this seems to be an implicit existence claim that there is some meaningful Euclidean theory of gravity, at least with ADS boundary conditions. It doesn't tell you how you deal with the contours, the conformal factor problems, but so far the discussion is couched entirely here. Now, this is similar to what one does with ordinary instantons, where you think of them as Euclidean solutions. But when you replace a small instanton with a local action, which you do also in QCD, that is something that you again believe you can continue back to Lorentzian space and use that local action. Somehow, what one is picturing, again, it's somehow you have some rapid tunneling process. This is the right Lorentzian language rather than a solution. But anyway, the discussion is couched entirely in Euclidean path integrals, but it's assumed that this effective action is what a Lorentzian observer would also see.
Where do you actually use that? It's Euclidean?
These solutions are only Euclidean solutions. The Lorentzian continuation, you have some obvious directions to try to slice and continue, but I wouldn't know what it would mean.
I think that's a bank becomes.
Yeah, the Lorentzian. Well, the Bayer universe is collapsing.
If you slice here, if this is your static surface, it collapses, right?
Yeah.
If you slice here, I don't know what it does. But I guess if you slice here, I think if you slice here, the problem is you have the wrong kind of matter when you continue back.
All finite topologies collapse unless you do something really nasty with the energy conditions.
So in the Euclidean ADS, the fluxes are imaginary, right?
In the Euclidean ADS, the fluxes are real. The fluxes which support the ADS are imaginary. Yes, that's true.
But yours just are added real.
Let's see, wait a second. The fluxes which support the ADS are imaginary. Yes. The added ones are real.
So you have some sort of complex flux going on here?
They're different components. They're different components. Yeah. So some I had forgotten here that the one that the flux that supports the Euclidean ADS is in fact complex.
You have more than the Hawking page transition. Will these begin to dominate at a certain under certain conditions?
So let me. Well, I don't know if they can dominate because I want to argue they're not there, right? So this gauge theory, again, the gauge theory, the 2+1 d1 d5 super Yang Mills 1+1 constructs a bulk theory, which has wormhole solutions. And so if it really sums over all topologies, it should include things like this. And again, I would argue, I've already said that I don't believe this can happen because of cluster decomposition. Let me try to provide an equation that goes with that. So if we consider a periodic ADS space and sort of two local processes, we call this amplitude 1, and amplitude 2, and this is tau 1, and this is tau 2. Then from what I've told you, if wormholes are present, then what you're going to see here is, again, because I've as you see in the picture, I've chosen the times long, only the ground state will contribute to leading order. Whereas in the field theory,
is again in finite volume, n is finite, it has a finite number of fields, and so it should have a ground state which is unique or at most a finite degeneracy. So this is plus exponential corrections from higher intermediate states. Whereas the field theory should have a unique vacuum. Or again, a vacuum of finite degeneracy, but not this continuous degeneracy. Again, plus exponentially small. And these two are not the same. That is, you can't write an integral over a product as a product. And so this is just a way of trying to make more precise the statement that the field theory really satisfies cluster decomposition things. Propagate locally in time, and the wormhole is non-local. So now I think that the conclusion is that when the field theory builds the sum over geometries, it doesn't include these topologies. I don't know what this is, sort of experimental quantum gravity. And then in this experiment, one finds that these topologies don't contribute.
You're assuming something about the log theory, maybe that it has some positive decomposition when alpha is fixed.
Yeah, I'm assuming that. That is normal. I mean, a field theory, well.
It's not a field theory.
No, but make G string small so there's, things, graph the metrics approximately classical.
Joe, is this different from saying that we just don't have analogs of the alpha parameters in the dual CFT?
Well, okay, good. Yes, it is. Now, there's a strong tendency for people who work on ADS-CFT to say, well, I know that I can try to put the wormholes in. Because something that you can imagine doing is in the boundary theory to add something which is bilinear and bilocal and sum over it. But this doesn't put the wormholes in, because there's certainly a difference between something happening in the bulk and something happening on the boundary. It's the difference between two particles, effectively, between a particle disappearing from the interior and appearing here, and a particle propagating out to the boundary, disappearing and reappearing here. So the claim is, right, the local laws of gravity do not include these wormholes, and it's not that there's different theories. When you change the boundary conditions, you don't change the bulk physics.
If you identify radius with scale, you might think you'd have to put in bilocal operators with arbitrarily large size.
Somehow
an operator, a local operator is at the boundary, but a big one is.
Good. That sounds
bulk.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty nasty.
Right. So in fact, this mark is gone, but the local uniqueness of string theory, seems to be surviving here. You can't change the rules.
Well, I was wondering about Eva's work with others about having multi-trace operators on the boundary. If that doesn't give a little bit of non-locality.
Well, that gives a different kind of non-locality. That gives a non-locality in the sphere directions. It's a non-local boundary condition, which
different
from this. Well, two questions. Another one. We also heard from various people that the topology of space could change. Right. Is this consistent with that?
Eva can describe sort of a baby universe breaking off. The paradox, the effect.
Right, but this was consistent with what you're saying, because we never found the total disconnection in an ADS-CFT context, which wasn't already in some entangled state.
Okay.
A single boundary, which I thought was consistent.
Okay. But this is, although ADS is being used as a laboratory here, it's only a laboratory. The ADS curvature is small compared to the wormhole size. So this is also a statement about quantum gravity in our neighborhood or any context, allegedly. Now, one of the things is when.
How is this consistent? So you're saying it's simply now. Apparently a prediction of string theory that there are no wormholes in quantum gravity.
When some clever person figures out how to rewrite the path integral over pH fields as a path integral over metrics, it won't include these sala points.
Well, but
Okay, topology can change.
Are you?
Okay, Marty's been waiting for a long time, so either quickly. Marty.
Was there an answer to my question in there?
There seem to be four of them. Could you restate your question?
Well, my question was, is it consistent with the idea?
Would somebody from the audience like to answer the question? Is it consistent with the breaking up of the universes?
I thought it was because
that's enough.
I think the real problem comes with the universe. They came from loops of universes. Once you have loops of universes, universes separating and reattaching.
Right.
That's when you you're forced to add alpha parameters that are not constant but are integrated.
So what I would say we know from these perturbative processes is that you can start with a universe connected by a neck and split them off, but that's not the same as a quantum process in which they reconnect.
Can't be joined somehow. So it could bifurcate. That's okay.
Eva's process used to bother me, but I think bifurcation is not. Doesn't lead to these paradoxes.
All right, good.
Marty's been waiting a long time.
If the effect of these wormholes introduces alpha parameters, which you said was essentially a kind of averaging over different coupling constants, then maybe you should be looking for some sort of averaging over coupling constants.
No, that's the statement that would be a boundary. That would be similar, but it would be a boundary, not a locality. And and if I'm an observer in the bulk, I can tell there's been a particle disappearing locally, and one that propagates over the boundary over there and then disappears. So they're different. They're distinguishable.
Okay. So one thing I could say, you proved that the ADS CFD correspondence doesn't work. Right. You just found the counterexample. Well, let me turn it again and ask: what if it's not true that all that have to sum over all topologies which have the same conformal boundary? And you say that Tamvaka so has shown that this is a system which has the same conformal boundary. Then actually, I'm at loss now. What are the rules now?
Well, actually. Steve, you want to help take my answer what the rules are?
Well, maybe one of the rules.
Yes.
At the risk of being provocative,
yes.
And I will admit this could be wrong, but it's something that would, I think, possibly resolve your problem. There were if you couldn't resolve from the boundary theory information on scales small as compared to the ABS radius, okay, I think that would get you out of this problem. Another way of saying that is that perhaps ADS CFT is a correspondence between the low energy effective field theory in the bulk on scales small as compared to 1 over R and the boundary theory. And I think that at least points in the direction that could get you out of this, because you just wouldn't see the effects of it.
It doesn't have to be that weak, even. If we're going to reevaluate what ADS CFT means, we could just propose that the CFT is dual to an ADS string theory in which all values of the alpha parameters happen to be exactly zero, for example, in which case it could still be exactly string theory in that context.
I think there's any natural way to choose that.
Actually, I'd like to ask in other approaches to quantum gravity, there is occasionally discussion of sort of restricting to causal. Most of what we've heard about here has been sort of canonical, and so you don't talk about space-time, but space. But the restriction to causal space-times. Does any of this ring a bell right there? And does it connect with what you all are doing?
I think in either of these approaches, first of all, nothing is done in detailed calculation. But conceptually, there can still be topology change even in the canonical approach. And the reason for that is just that, a priori, the point is that you may have this manifold, but you may have these kind of spin networks that are given everywhere, and they have these little labels. And as time evolves, the spin network change, the label change, and so on. And it can happen that, in fact, the labels become all zero in some big region like that. And so from a perspective of space-time geometry, not a manifold, it will really look like you start with something which is connected and then grows into different directions. So, I don't think it is really, but actually, it is related to something else. Namely, many, many years ago, there was this idea that maybe one can do something like the philosophy of AD and CFT, but the idea was that, well, you look at null infinity, and somehow you can build a theory just on sky plus and sky minus, and it will tell you something. But it was much more mundane compared to AD and CFT in a way, because sky plus and sky minus are good characteristic initial value surfaces and so on. Which is, and so actually there was this, I actually carried out a not good asymptotic quantization understanding D in this group and such thing. But then the reason why this program stopped was because I felt that maybe this will just get, will really, such a theory would contain only a sector of general relativity. And in our case, it would be a rather boring sector in which there are only weak field gravitational waves coming in and coming out and not forming anything. Now, so why, I mean, this is the thing that Steve always emphasizes, that, well, no, the boundary theory is complete. So, but still, I don't see why it could, even though the boundary theory is complete in the sense that the Hamiltonian evolution sort of doesn't affect, you know, it's completely well defined and all that, why it could not correspond to a sector of something that is interior. Not some dumb sector like the one, you know, with just weak field fluctuations, but still a sector which just doesn't allow, for example.
There must be a completely decoupled sector.
Yeah,
sure. But anything
is not clear, that can be completely coupled.
I mean, gravity couples everything, right?
Right.
Well, it could be the effective field theory on large scale. That's a sector.
Yeah, no, but you can't keep theory on the large scale. It's not a complete theory.
It certainly is a sector in the sense that we've restricted to asymptotically ADS boundary.
No, but even with that thing, asymptotically ADS boundary conditions, even that, I still don't know what complete means. I mean, maybe somebody can tell what complete means. I mean,
maybe you can prepare by throwing stuff in from the boundary. Throw in a bunch of stuff, make a black hole.
But that is a conjecture. Yeah, I mean, in the sense that, we have a complete set of observables in the boundary.
Right, you're but throwing in arbitrary stuff.
But these are kind of S-matrix kind of observables, right? And maybe I cannot
you can make a black hole. I mean,
but I cannot make maybe wormholes. I cannot maybe take a change to
wormholes doesn't mean that you should make. They're either there or they're not. And I'm happy, I'm actually happy with the conclusion that they're not there.
Well, wait a minute, Joe. I mean, as you say, we've been working under the assumption that every classical solution has some
tentative assumption
that every classical solution has some role in the quantum theory. So now you're arguing that this class of solutions don't have any role. So what are the rules? I mean, how do we know in advance which classical solutions are going to enter and which aren't?
That's why I thought there were claims that you should start with Lorentzian gravity only with causal. Somehow we
could
causal structures and then rotate from there.
What you're thinking of is this program by Jan Bjorn and Rafa Bolle, where they have a Euclidean quantum gravity foliation.
Yes. What do you think? Yeah.
So is there anyone in the room who feels qualified to comment on this?
Well, they're doing a Euclidean functional integral over geometries, over dynamical triangulation sets that with. But limiting them to geometries that would support a Lorentzian metric.
So that would indicate,
There is a preferred foliation, so that would rule out.
That would probably also rule out the Hawking transition, I guess. Right? Can you take a two of these wormholes together and get them turned into nothing? Is it like a wormhole and an anti-wormhole?
Well, they do have a charge, which would be zero if they brought them together. But
so you can think of a wormhole and anti-wormhole on top of each other as a perturbative fluctuation.
Well, it
it has a different.
Yes or no? What are you? Where are you going?
here's a piece of paper.
I'm not sure what you
mean. Come on, so the argument that you have to include instantons
but you have to,
in the field theory is like that
you
can make an instantaneous instanton out of a...
In terms of ordinary topology, these are not continuously connected to...
Yeah.
You know, this space has a... This space has a
so there's no way to make them connected.
Right.
There's no way that you can.
And these words were said back in the old days. We said, well, look, strings do this, and so universes should too, right?
strings meaning world sheets?
Yeah, world sheets.
Let's see, just one supportive comment, right? I mean, the problem of summing over topologies is very complicated because in sufficiently high dimensions like five, there's no algorithm. It's one of those great unsolvable problems for telling at least two when two simplicity manifolds are the same. So it's not a bad idea to have to get rid of topological complexity, especially when the problem
replication.
We have to solve
therefore you know
has already been proved to be by the mathematicians unsolvable.
Can I get slightly more technical question. So you have some supersymmetry in the system. Are there fermion zero modes on these instants? Could they cancel against each other?
Good. So, certainly the local physics in the bulk is supersymmetric, and the operators that you would induce would be, high dimension and fully supersymmetric. But there's an infinite number of those.
So it would be a miracle if they all cancel that. I mean, we know some circumstances where sums of instantons do cancel.
But you could look for a 16 fermion process here and a 16 fermion process here, just designed to see those operators.
So that's not an easy out. But there are some situations where it's not by a zero mode argument instantons cancel. So we can't really rule that out.
I heard the cheese and wine already there.
Yeah, it seems unlikely, yeah. Because
this happens with some world sheets on the Calabi.
Their contributions to certain things cancel, but you probably see them if you put the right probe in there.
Yeah. So a while ago, Steve Giddings and Amy Strominger and I did a calculation of black hole pair creation in a magnetic field and got a result consistent with black hole entropy, but this pair of black holes that you create are connected by a wormhole. They share an interior. So is that process also forbidden by your
question. Is it this kind of wormhole, or is it a wormhole's persistence in time?
It's a spatial wormhole.
Well, once you create the black holes, the wormhole throat collapses. These are basically two separate black holes whose interiors coincide, but that's still a wormhole and it's still topology.
It's like the Einstein Rosen.
Yeah. So is this process also forbidden? Form this pair of black holes?
Experimentally, I'd say no.
That would have to be allowed. But I mean, it does seem like since we have very strong evidence that topology can change and split, and you're saying it can't recombine, this is somehow an argument for an arrow of time.
One possibility.
That would be a mistake to draw that conclusion.
Really?
I was providing you to say.
Some bacteria have two mutations.
Only one.
But they are zero.
ABS boundary condition. You can set it up with two boundaries, split them apart, but that's just an entangled state. So there's no conflict. I mean, this happens in more topological settings and so on, which, as Joe emphasized, ADS CFT simply doesn't cover.
I think also Hong's point is that at n equals infinity, there can be an effective arrow of time. You might have to wait a very long time for this thing to remind you that it's time reversible. You might have to wait a recurrence time.
Right, I'm just saying it's an out for this question.
Okay. I'm told that the wine and cheese are here.
Let me just provide my own conclusion, which is that after the work of the early 1989, I never want to think about the subject again. And I thought the moral here was that nobody ever has to. It could be, but I guess there's more.
So, Joe, I think we talked about it.
So there's some complicated
strings with two-dimensional gravity.
And they are
I think you're really happy to be able to. Right, so. And is there a way of thinking about some.
I have absolutely.
I think
would you like us to give us some of the
even though we don't know what the other system is, right? We don't have a good description of the
Right, but that's because
so I think that's the